Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight into how it affects our national deterrence. We hope you enjoy this show.
And welcome to another great episode of the NIDS View. I am Curtis McGiffin, your host today. I know it's not Adam. Adam Lowther is on assignment along with Jim Petrosky. They have entrusted me to do this all by myself. So my big boy pants are on, and I have a great guest to join us today. And that is Jim Klingmeier. Jim's not only my personal friend and colleague of some 25 years, but he's also the director and founder of the Lafayette Group, a nonprofit 501c3 that specializes in, of all things, hostage recovery and humanitarian efforts, regardless of location. But we'll talk more about that in a moment. Jim's a retired Air Force colonel, and his distinguished career as an intelligence officer in a variety of operational intelligence and information operations assignments. He served as a chief of both the Airborne and the Tactical Intelligence Collections Divisions at U.S. CENTCOM from 2002 to 2004. Please note those dates. That's about the time when we launched Operation Iraqi Freedom. He later served as the U.S. Air Attaché in Japan. Jim's Air Force service culminated as the Chief of International Engagement at the Headquarters Air Force in the Pentagon. He's got extensive experience and insight in Asia, ranging from the hotspots of the Middle East to the shores of the Pacific, which makes him a trusted expert in his field, and it's why he's on the show today. Jim, welcome to the NIDS View.
Thank you. Thank you, Curtis. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. But, you know, before we get started with the show today, I wanted to take a minute or two for you to explain to our listeners what your organization, Lafayette Group, does for America, and why is the company motto Stamus Contra Malum, which is Latin for "We stand against evil." Sounds really cool.
Yeah, that was my big thought piece for putting it on the web. First of all, thanks again for having me. The Lafayette Group, I came to work in the hostage recovery realm when I was working for Governor Bill Richardson and his group going in and out of Syria, starting way back in 2018. And we were the only ones and still remain the only ones who are going in country. And it became apparent after a few trips in that this was not going to be a identification, proof of life, rescue type thing. And to be clear, we don't do the rescue piece. We do the recovery. So I made a promise to the families of Kayla Mueller, Steve Sotloff, Peter Kasich, all of them, that, you know, I would stick with it. And so I continue to go even today, and I'm going out again in a few weeks to do the recovery piece, because I think the families deserve to have their loved ones return. Unfortunately, it's a place where, you know, there's not a lot of good. There is a lot of evil.
Yeah.
And when we're in there, we are traveling fast and loose and trying to make things happen.
Well, that's it's fantastic. You know, we always wonder, you know, who are the people who go into these dangerous places and bring Americans home to rest, more or less. And I think it's fantastic that you're one of those who are engaged in that and doing so with empathy and experience. And it's clearly you've won the trust of these families. And I'm sure it's a very dangerous activity, and one that requires a lot of advanced planning, logistics, and so forth. So God bless you for doing that work. You want to tell our folks what your website is, if they want to learn more about you or perhaps donate to you?
Absolutely. It's LafayetteGRP.org. Again, LafayetteGRP.org. It's a nonprofit 501c3. Been doing it since 2018 and hope to keep doing it well into the future. Unfortunately, I don't think it's ever going to end. You know, I mean, we're working in Syria and Iraq and North Africa now, but, you know, we're being asked to go to other places across the globe. So
sure. Okay. Well, thank you for that. It's again, it's, I'm glad to have you here. You've got this distinguished experience. And so what I thought we'd do today, here at the, we're at the end of October. The last time I hosted, one of these, sort of by myself, we kind of did a review of some of the news, some of the things that interest, well, frankly, interest me. And so we've selected a couple of topics, here for the month of October. And, I thought it would be really cool for our listeners to hear, what a seasoned intelligence thinker, might be thinking about some of these things, given your experience all over the world.
Sure.
So first, we're gonna talk about the North Koreans have invaded Eastern Europe. You know, and no, I'm not talking about some heavy metal band. We are talking about, you know, real bona fide troops that have shown up. What I find interesting about this, Jim, is just a few days ago, I think somewhere around maybe the 25th of October, the Pentagon released an official notification that it was that they believe there were 3,000 North Korean troops that had shown up into Russia to engage in the in this Ukrainian conflict.
Yeah.
And just 2 or 3 days later, they come out and go, no, we're just kidding. It's 10,000. And that just came out here on the 28th of October, as reported by AP. And clearly, NATO is engaged on this. The new Secretary General, Mark Rutte, has made several statements about this. A lot of folks are just sort of perplexed on the macro scale as to whether or not 10,000 North Korean troops are going to make a difference in this conflict. But before I ask anything, or we, you know, sort of go into this specifically, maybe you could share with us, Jim, maybe your thoughts on this North Korean inclusion into this conflict, and maybe just in general your thoughts on the Ukraine conflict here.
You know, I was a bit surprised when it was out in the press. I mean, I think we would be naive, both in the intel community and an open source community, to think that the North Koreans and the Chinese, maybe even the Iranians, don't have boots on the ground. This is a perfect opportunity for them to learn, you know, the tactics, techniques, procedures of not just Ukraine, but also the weapon systems that we have sold them. So I think they're learning. I think they've probably been there for a while. I doubt that North Korea would send 10,000 in overnight. There was probably a learning process, probably some coordination going on. But I, if I understood correctly, I think I read today that the Russians aren't real enamored with with the individuals that have shown up. And you know, I think in the open press, they said the North Korean soldiers were akin to working great in the mountainous regions of North Korea and South Korea, if that ever happened, but not so much in the trenches of you know, Russia and Ukraine. So I think that they're quite simply going to be fodder. I think they're going to be thrown forward with a, you know, a weapon, 10 rounds, and told to go and take, you know, a Ukrainian position, which I think the Ukrainians have gotten really smart and they've gotten really hardened. And I think that, you know, that they have the technology, or at least the advantage technically right now. So we shall see.
Interesting point you were referring about the sort of the disagreement. There was some, I guess the Ukrainian intelligence services released, it was reported on CNN, some audio that they captured of Russian troops sort of going, who are these people? Why are they here? You know, using some foul language and whatnot, referring even to the Koreans as Chinese, this idea that they were going to have a number of officers, including interpreters, per 30 people, and these sorts of things. So it sounds to me like there's going to be sort of a big cultural issue here. Maybe the Russians and the North Koreans are going to need to have some, going to need to go to some DEI courses or something to sort of make sure they can all get along.
I think what is going to end up happening here is North Korea offered something that Russia needs very badly, and that's manpower.
Yeah.
But I think that there's certainly going to be a quid pro quo.
Oh, yeah.
And what that could be, unfortunately, and it dovetails to your organization's genesis, is that there's going to be technology possibly transferred from Russia to North Korea. And, and there lies the problem of, tipping the scales, so to speak, in Asia. If North Korea had the technology that they want from the Russian Federation when it comes to missiles, weapons, what have you. But again, I think also the Chinese are also probably in Ukraine as well.
Oh, interesting. I think you're spot on here. There have been outside reports that upwards of 50% of the Russian artillery is now North Korean supplied. And so we're seeing this relationship. Obviously, they signed a defense pact here a few months ago. And you're spot on. This is what worries me the most about this. I'm not worried about 10,000 North Korean troops in Ukraine. I think the Ukrainians are going to handle that just fine. Mm-hmm. What I'm worried about is the payback that Putin owes KJU, and that's going to come in the form of nuclear technology, weapons grade, supplies. And in the end, my prediction here, I'm going to say it right here on this show, is in 5 years, we're going to see a marked increase in North Korean ballistic missile, including ICBMs and SLBM capability. They're going to be more accurate, more reliable, more modern, so to speak. And this is exactly what KJU wants. So I think he's getting probably a really good end to this bargain. And that's the unfortunate part here. The other thing I'm going to offer here, and maybe you might want to comment on this, is this is another form of escalation, right? So we've heard a lot of statements about, well, the North Koreans, they're fair game. I think there's that for the Ukrainians to target, that they're not going to withhold anything on them. They're not worried about an international scandal of killing North Korean soldiers. But I think they call them co-belligerents now, an interesting term. But I think what this is a form of escalation, and what Putin is doing is he is horizontally escalating by increasing the geography of who's participating in this war. And so he's trying to communicate to the West, I think, that he is ready to go to this next level without having to go to the nuclear level. So it's another form of escalation in that matter, trying to remind us in the West that he is in this for the long haul. He is not going to quit, and he will continue to garner whatever capabilities and capacities he can rescue out of friends and allies. What do you think of that?
Yeah, no, I agree. I think, we grew up with the Warsaw Pact and the Soviet Union. So the Warsaw Pact is obviously no more. But the nightmare scenario is that the Warsaw Pact has now evolved to new countries, North Korea, China, Russia, Iran. And if you look at all these countries and they grow their weapon systems, a nuclear weapon system, well, then we are no longer focusing on just one or two countries. We're focusing on much, and you look at Chinese expansion of their nuclear missiles and some of the measures they take to hide their efforts. We are now dealing with a world where we no longer have the luxury of focusing on one European threat, right? Or one Chinese threat. It is expanded. And so it's something to think of, as Congress and DOD, plus up on testing missiles, modification, what have you. It's something we're going to have to get serious about.
Yeah.
I feel like a lot of times you know, the adversaries of the United States play chess and we play checkers. And we do a great job doing pickup ball, right? Whenever someone, Pearl Harbor, 9/11, we do a great job of crushing whoever we need to crush. Unfortunately, in this case, you know, it's only going to take minutes. This isn't going to be a weeks, months, years thing. This is going to take minutes, and we're going to end up in a tough spot. So that's just my humble opinion.
No, I appreciate that very much. For those of you out there who are interested, you can really follow along here. And the trick will be is to sort of monitor to see how successful these North Koreans are. Do more come? Are they, what quality of troops they are? Do they all defect? If I'm a Ukrainian information operations guy, I'm going to try to convince the North Koreans to defect to Ukraine, that they'll have a much better life. They can actually, have a meal. It might be able to defeat this.
This is the first time that these guys will have been out of North Korea.
That's right.
I mean, that's something to think about. I mean, they're going to see, they're going to see tough love on parts of, they're going to see what the Russians want them to see. But at the end of the day, they're not, I don't think they're dumb. I think they're going to see things. They're like, oh, this is what it's like. Mm-hmm. But we're told that these aren't the A-team guys. These aren't their version of, the SEALs or
not their special forces.
This is line soldiers who are barely hanging on because they're used to eating grass.
All right. Well, we're going to move on to the next topic, Jim, and here that was sort of big news here in October, and that was the Biden administration's effort to to declare the intelligence agencies need to embrace AI, artificial intelligence. And now I know you are you've spent your whole life sort of I had to look this up and I kind of made up this term. Maybe you'll like it. Maybe other people will borrow it. But I know you're more interested in anthro intelligence than artificial intelligence. but apparently the administration may be just a little bit more interested in the fake stuff than in the real stuff, if you will.
Sure.
But there's clearly an interest in this. And I wanted to, there's a first ever national security memorandum on artificial intelligence, which was just signed here on October or released on October 24th. And it sort of directs a couple of things here that I really wanted to just point out to the listeners. And there's sort of a long dovetail to this. And so the memo sort of lays out, if you will, that the AI is an era defining technology, right? So I guess computers were sort of that in the 90s or in the 80s. Now today it's AI. And they want to lay out guidelines that the White House has designed to prevent the use of AI to harm civil liberties and human rights, as well as sort of be able to sort of lead the world in AI intelligence. There also seems to be an effort to sort of begin the push to sort of lay out the norms of international AI about how all states should use this. I know there's been some other pseudo policies that have been released on this, but these are very Western driven and they're automatically, I think, going to be rejected by the autocracies or what I refer to as the axis of autocracies that are clearly not interested in following the current rules-based international order. But they note specifically, that that they don't want to include this into the nuclear realm. And so there's a couple of things here in the articles that are noted out here from AP and CNN, highlighting that designing these things in order, but while trying to safeguard America's interests in human rights, I think is going to be an interesting thing to watch. It's going to be a delicate balancing act, right? Mm-hmm. As we go through this. And I guess National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan recently made a presentation at the National War College, one of near and dear to my heart, sort of to introduce this, sort of launch this idea out here. There's this idea now, Jim, that we might be entering into an AI arms race. What do you think about that?
you know, you've known me for a long time, and I've always said, you know, I am a idealist trapped in a realist world, right? And so there's the way it should be, and there is the way it is. And I think that I think it's a bit naive for us to go into this, first of all, with an expectation that the rest of the world is going to jump on and join, you know, us and our partners on how we are going to use and what we won't use AI for. You know, I mean, nation states do what's in their best interest, period. They can be great people, but they're going to do what's in their best interest. And I think that it's just going to, I think we're already there as far as an arms race with AI. I mean, you can look at, you know, the last election, there was a lot of talk about Russian interference and AI and spoofing and et cetera. And I think that's going to get worse, not better. I think it's going to come to a point where, you know, if any of your listeners want to make $1 million, I think if they could figure out a way to verify that that what people hear and see is 100%, you know, unequivocal truth, then they'll make $1 billion or more.
So we need AI to be able to detect AI. Right?
Yeah, and they don't have that. You remember when we were in the military, you always have the red team, right? The red team force who would always go against and look for vulnerabilities and gaps. But then, you know, you look at AI. I mean, I've used it when I've been overseas, particularly in Syria, for Overwatch for me. So checking all the social media feeds, checking all the uploads of cameras, and is anyone talking about, you know, this guy who's wandering around looking for things, just from a self-preservation perspective.
Right.
And you know, they came back with some stuff at times, which caused me to make modifications on where I was at. I think that, you know, AI is something that's, the genie's out of the bottle. There's no one's going to be able to put it back. And I think you would have to deal with reasonable partners or expectations with the individuals from China, Russia, North Korea, Iran, to sit down and have that. And I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think we're even close to having that sort of a discussion.
I think it's fascinating that you'd say that, you know, so the AI genie is out of the bottle. You know, we use that analogy a lot in the nuclear world. So that, you know, for nuclear weapons, the nuclear genie is out of the bottle. You can't unlearn nuclear weapons. And and what's interesting is that we're as a world, we seem to be trying to figure out better ways to do AI, but not better ways to do nuclear deterrence. We seem to poo-poo that. And yet there is some interest in sort of how do we connect these things together? Should we connect these things together? And you know, Adam and I wrote some pieces over the years on, you know, America needs a dead hand, and America needs a dead hand more than ever, where we've discussed the use of AI in the nuclear command and control architecture, and so forth. I would argue that some of the thinking is coming around to our side, perhaps. But I want to point out in this framework that was put out along with this NSM on AI, it was pillar one, which is the AI prohibited use of AI, right? So of all the things they say you can do, here's a list of the things in America that we're not going to do with AI, right? And so they go through this list, and it's, you know, a lot of it is very, to your point, you're an idealist trapped in a realist body. I'm a realist trapped in a realist body in a realist world. I understand that. I see it a little bit differently than you do. But, you know, they sort of lay out these rules where they say, you know, we're going to make sure AI doesn't unlawfully suppress the burden or burden the right to free speech. These sorts of things. And here's a challenge, you know, when you're trying to when we talk about fake news or disinformation and these sorts of things, you know, disinformation is kind of in the eye of the beholder. If propaganda is, you know, one man's propaganda is another man's disinformation sort of thing, you know, that I think we're kind of jousting at windmills when it comes to that, because so much of it is in the perception of the sender and the listener. But what I wanted to point out are the last two items on the pillar one list, because I think they're most appropriate to what we're discussing today. And that is, the first one is that I want to prohibit AI use cases that produce and disseminate reports or intelligence analysis based solely on AI outputs without sufficient warnings that enable the reader of the reports or analysis to recognize that the report or the analysis is based solely on AI. In other words, we're not going to produce AI-generated material without sort of a cautionary line at the end that says, hey, warning, this is AI-generated material.
Right.
So it's interesting. I understand the fear of automated bias and these sorts of things. I get it. I just think it's kind of fun that we're committing to doing this, but we still have to be, you know, we're going to make sure that we don't do anything without sort of, a safety line on there. And then the last one is, we will not remove a human in the loop for actions critical to informing and executing decisions by the president to initiate or terminate nuclear weapons employment. And so why does this matter? I mean, this would make sense or seems to make sense to many, many Americans. We just talked on a podcast last week about sole authority, and we went through sort of a review of some of the congressional bills that are out there to try to change some of those things. And we sort of discuss why that is. And why this is important here, Jim, is back in June of this year, Bill Gertz reports in the Washington Times that after being asked by President Biden, President Xi has came out and said that they were going to reject any limits on AI, any of AI use for its rapidly expanding nuclear forces. And essentially, they said, "We hear what you have to say, America, that you believe that you don't think that autonomous systems should be getting near any decision to launch nuclear weapons, but we disagree." And so the Chinese are clearly not interested, Jim, in your idealist views of how we should maybe not have AI in the system. Yeah. I think they're looking forward to having AI make things a lot easier for them. Does this shock you that President Xi is basically not on board with this?
No, just a point to clarify. I mean, I'm an idealist, caught in an idealist world.
So I'm not picking on you.
Things through the optic of like, everything is, roses and ponies. But, for your listeners, if they could just sit back for a second and think of the person on the other end of this microphone or on the other end of the computer, and let's just say for instance, it is a competition. Let's say between you and I, Curtis, and we have AI. We both have it. And I am using mine to the full capacity that that I have. And you are holding back. And we have to make a decision at some point whether we engage or whether we stand down. And if remember the old OODA loop, right? Or observe, orient, decide, act. If mine's compressed because of the use of AI allows it to be compressed, and my decisions can be made in seconds while you're still pontificating with your staff what to do, in all likelihood, the win will go to me.
Right?
And I don't think, short of a hotline where someone's going to pick up the phone and call, do I think it's going to ever come to a point where Skynet is alive and well? I don't think so. But I think that people, like I said earlier, nation states do things that are in their best interest, their interest, not someone else.
Absolutely.
And I think that it's foolish for us to think that, the rest of the world will snap in and get behind our, where we want things to go. That's just my
opinion. I agree completely. I think it's bad for deterrence to constantly tell the adversary what you won't do. Exactly. And we're very good at that. And this is one of them because now there's no motivation for them to come to the table because we've already said we won't do it. And we now have a presidential memorandum that says we won't do it.
Right.
And so there's no incentive for the Chinese to come to the table to negotiate. They're not afraid of America using AI and getting inside of their OODA loop or being able to decide faster than they will. And right. I think that does give them some level of superiority in the decision-making cycle anyway, as we look through this. And I think this is continuing to be a challenge because this goes to sort of the administration's desire to continue to to hope that they can lead by example and create a more safer world. But the world's not following in some of these decisions. And I think that is something of note. But let me add one more thing. And this ought not to surprise you, Jim. You're an old Air Force veteran like me. And that is just on the 28th of October, like within a day or two of the president's listing, though, General Cotton, the commander of Strategic Command, released a statement that AI, quote, will enhance, unquote, nuclear command and control, says the Stratcom boss, an article by Greg Hadley in the Air and Space magazine. And it said that Stratcom is exploring all possible technologies, techniques, and methods to assist with the modernization of our NC3 capabilities, and that AI, quote, AI will enhance our decision-making capabilities, unquote. But we must never allow artificial intelligence to make those decisions for us. I think that sort of falls in line, that statement, I didn't quote an unquote, but there it is, with the president's goals. But clearly, General Cotton sees value in having some version of the AI to be in there. It says here in the article that Cotton said AI, quote, can give leaders more decision space to ensure the entire nuclear enterprise stays secure. I think they're finding that tight rope that needs to be walked. Mm-hmm. And whatnot. Does it surprise you, Jim, that right after the president's list comes out, I'm sure there's nothing nefarious to this. General Cotton is a good airman, and he is doing his thing, and I fully support his statements here. I just think it's kind of weird that it's sort of right there right on the cusp of the new presidential guidance. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if you got into the budget process and you started looking at the 5-year plan. If, you know, big AI behemoths, you know, pick a company out there in the Beltway, in DC, or wherever. And I'm sure they're already lining up to be that supplier of AI to DOD, specifically to Stratcom.
Right.
You know, I part of me says, hallelujah. That you know, we need to have that, but part of me also scratches my head, and I'm sure, you know, the general and a lot of other folks are a lot smarter than me, but I scratch my head and think, well, what if it isn't everything it's, you know,
right,
supposed to be, and therein lies the crux, right? We want it, we need it, but do we really want it? Do we really need it?
Well, I think the point here is that our adversaries want it and they're going to do it. And so
exactly.
The second half of your question is kind of already answered, right? Yeah. So we cannot continue to be an analog watch when all of our adversaries are digital watches. And so we're going to have to figure out how to do this. And if there's an insistence of having a man in the loop, that's fine. Make that happen. But we should not throw the AI baby out with the AI bathwater. We need to make sure that we are incorporating into the nuclear enterprise where AI can really help the problem and not eschew it just because it's conflated with everything else nuclear.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think a perfect example would be the Iron Dome system in Israel.
Yeah.
They put that on automatic mode. There is no man hitting a button.
Well, right? There you go.
They turn it to automatic and then off it goes.
But, right. And it could, you know, no one seems to be too concerned that they might, you know, be shooting down, you know, something accidentally. The last thing I want to bring up here in the remaining couple of minutes that we have left, Jim, is that the DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, just released this month here on October 23rd, report, if you will, Nuclear Challenges and Challenges Intelligence Overview. This is the title here. It's a mm-hmm. kind of an odd title to me, but basically it's sort of an updated an unclassified overview of the nuclear programs of Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran. And look, there's a few things that are sort of controversial in here. A lot mm-hmm. of it is sort of regurgitation of stuff we've already seen in recent reports that have come out late last year and earlier this year. And so that ought not to surprise anybody. But there are a couple of things that I sort of want to put out here in front of our listeners and maybe give you a moment to comment on here as before we roll on. And that is a couple of things here. So they note that Beijing has expanded its ICBM, its solid propellant ICBM silos, quote, by about 300. So we get these little intel games, right? So we're not going to tell you exactly how many. We're going to say about 300. And that they are both capable of fielding, that they are capable of fielding both the DF-31 and the DF-41 class ICBMs, which have been reported both in these reports and outside by other outside agencies that they are MIRVing systems with multiple warheads. So I think that is a new piece of interesting information for the American people, is that they're now saying the two most modern ICBMs that have been developed in China are going to go in these new systems. In these new silos.
Sure.
The other thing they've noted is that there was an increase from the estimated deployed nuclear warheads from 200 in 2018 to 500 in 2030. Now, the 500 or about 500, or in some cases 500 or more, is what was reported in the China report to Congress earlier this year. That's not new, but I just want to reiterate, it's a 150% increase in deployed nuclear warheads in 6 years. And then the report says they'll be at 1,000.
1,000, yep.
By 2030. So in another 6 years, they'll double again. Yep. Right. So can we, and then they're saying, okay, so let's follow the trend, Jim. So then all the other intel reports that are unclassed, publicly shared with the American people says, but they're going to stop at 1500 in 2035. Well, why aren't they going to be at 2000? If they doubled in 6 years, they doubled again in 6 years. Why won't they double again in 6 years and get by 2036? Have 2,000 warheads? It just seems to me, why not?
I think we should expect that. I think you know, every time that they have said they are going to do X, instead they have done Y. Not every time, but most of the time,
right?
You know, and when you look at not just the numbers going from 500 to 1,000, but also on their tells with DF, what is it, 26? The co-mingling,
the Guam Buster
of the warheads, right? So. Mm-hmm. You can throw a nuclear weapon on there, or you can throw a conventional weapon on there.
Right.
And that makes it tough. That makes it tough to figure out which ones you want to hit, which ones we need to hit if that day ever comes. I think that, again, you know, we need to do a better job, and we need to have hard, hard conversations about where we want our country to be with respect to China, Russia, North Korea, and Iran.
Right.
When it comes to nuclear power, I just don't think we're going down the right path. Strength is deterrence, yes, but I feel like at times we are not as strong as we should be.
I hear exactly. I don't disagree with anything you're saying, Jim. I would say though, and you probably, as a former intel guy, know this better than I do. When I say, I think they know what these real numbers are. What bothers me is that they're not telling the American people what these real numbers are. And you know, they may be hiding behind sources and method excuses and things like that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's not really hard to know, you know, if you're looking at a satellite picture or whatever. Sure. I don't understand why we want to keep this a secret from the American people, unless it's a political decision, which is, you know, an interesting problem. If your party is more interested in nuclear disarmament rather than nuclear armament, and want to avoid arms races and these sorts of things. And so when we think about what's being reported to us, I would ask, you know, our listeners, go and read this DIA report. It's well produced, by the way. It's a good report. Yeah. It's well produced. I mean, it's like a magazine you'd get at the grocery store, with lots of glossy photos and things like that, and cool charts. But what bothers me is what it's not telling us. And I really think that the American people ought to be asking about that, through their, you know, through their congressional representatives or whatever they might be. But one of the things I'll note here is a final report as we close things out, because we are running over, is that Beijing, quote, I'm quoting this report, Beijing will probably will seek to increasingly integrate nuclear deterrence during conventional crises as part of a unified multi-domain crisis management framework. Well, that's very Pentagonese for, hey, they might threaten to use nukes when they're in a conventional conflict. Think about what that might be as we all talk about that, you know, with regard to Taiwan. The PLA continues, I'm quoting again, the PLA continues to discuss conventional and nuclear signaling, war control, counter space, and cyberspace operations as a mean for crisis management. And that, I'm arguing here in combination, there's another statement that says, and so let me fall to that real quick, that Chinese military writings, I'm quoting again, have noted that the introduction of new, precise, small-yield nuclear weapons could allow for the controlled use of theater-range nuclear weapons for warning and deterrence. Such discussions provide PLA doctrinal basis for limiting nuclear employment on the battlefield, suggesting Chinese nuclear thinkers could be reconsidering their longstanding view that nuclear war is uncontrollable, unquote. And what this is sort of telling us without telling us is that the Chinese are sort of rethinking that, hey, maybe nukes are a usable weapon in a conflict with another nuclear power. And I would argue that this flies in the face of another assessment in the same report that says, quote, China's public declaratory no first use policy is consistent with this approach to using their nuclear force, i.e. through their buildup. I just don't see how they can have it both ways.
They can't.
And so if we are considering even the possibility of getting engaged with the People's Republic of China over Taiwan or South China Sea or any other things that could possibly draw some sort of conflict with China, if we're not thinking about nuclear in the course of that conflict, we are lying to ourselves. What do you think?
I agree. I mean, years ago, when I would engage with the Chinese, I mean, years ago, they would tell me, you know, Jim, you are the true superpower. The U.S. is the one and only superpower. And then flash forward a few years later, we're at an event and they're looking at some U.S. Navy ships and they're like, we can take this among themselves. And you just kind of look at them and they say, well, Jim, you live life in 4-year cycles. We live life in 400-year cycles. We will be strong. We will be powerful. There is very little you can do about it because your country isn't hardwired to be able to engage on hard things. And of course, I disagreed. But it's clear to me that the Chinese are setting things up to where we are going to get boxed in at some point. And we're either going to have to just, you know, oh, this is not the issue we want to deal with. This is not the fight we want to fight, whatever that excuse is. And we're going to end up having a tough time, right? And I think it's unfortunate. Again, we just need tough discussions. And I don't know if those are occurring, honestly.
Yeah, I hear you. Well, Jim, I want to thank you. That is fantastic. And I'm sure that the story you just relayed is probably 15, 20 years old, which means they've been thinking about this for a long time.
Right.
And we're now just seeing it. They're just so patient. And then all of a sudden they surge and build 300 missile silos in a span of 2 years. So this is the challenge that we have. We can't stick our heads in the sand and ignore this. It's good that reports like this are coming out. I just wish they would be more clear with the American people about what the American people are going to have to pay for and what they should be fielding and understanding what is coming down the path. I mean, we're $36 trillion in debt. We're going to need to know that. Right. And so these things matter. Well, this is going to do it. We kind of went over. I apologize. Hopefully our listeners who are commuting in and around the Beltway and you know, maybe there's a little bit of traffic, so they're grateful that we went a little long. But I'm not grateful that I would be in that traffic. And I think it's one of the best things for me who lives in the great state of Tennessee that I don't have that traffic anymore. But nonetheless, here we are. I want to thank you, Jim, for coming on and sharing your insight with us. And good luck with the Lafayette Group and your hostage rescue or hostage recovery mission, I should say. And wish you the best of luck and all the safety and blessings in the world as you go in and do that great business. I want to remind our listeners to check us out here at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. Check us out on our website at thinkdeterrence.com. You can follow us on LinkedIn at Think Deterrence. You can find us on Twitter X at Think Deterrence. And take a part of that. You can listen to our podcast. We've got The Nuclear View, which you just heard, comes out every Wednesday. Nuclear Knowledge every Monday, a little education. We have Deterrence Down Under, where our Australian colleagues talk about deterrence in the Pacific. And, of course, Real Space Strategy with Chris Stone talking about what deterrence and things might be going on in space. They come out periodically on The Nuclear Knowledge as well. We do hope that you'll check us out. And as always, we wish you a great end of October. And as we always, we want to remind you to think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to The NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.